Welcome to the March 6th Development Engineering Advisory Board meeting. My name is Ryan Wilson. I'm the current president of DEEB, and we'll start with introductions.
Seth Hauling with AKS Engineering.
Mike Odrin, McKay Sposito.
Eric Galimo, SGA Engineering.
Andrew Gunther, PLS Engineering.
Dan Weisner, Songbird Homes.
Brent Davis, Land Use Review, Community Development.
Yeah, go for it, Rod.
Rod Swanson, Clark County Public Works Department.
Houston Aho, Aho Construction.
Noelle Levern, Executive Officer of the Building Industry Association.
April Firth, Director of Community Development.
Melanie Davis, Development Engineering Community Development.
And those online.
Dan Trisler with Haley and Aldridge.
Trista Kobleski with OTAC.
Diana Nett, Development Engineering.
Naomi Patti Bumla, Development Engineering.
Jackie Lane.
Justin Wood, Clark County Association of Realtors.
Kevin Tyler, Clark County Public Works.
Hunter Decker, Clark County Public Works.
Victoria Abram, Program Coordinator for Building Safety.
Luca Van Haley and Aldridge.
Okay, did
Washington
we get every
Department of Fish and Wildlife? Sorry, just me.
Okay, do we got everybody then? Anybody missed? Thank you. And just as a reminder that this DEEB meeting is being recorded and the audio will be posted on the DEEB's website. Our next order of business is to review and adopt the minutes from the February meeting. February 6th meeting, yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I've reviewed, and at least the part not having to do with stormwater, because I'm not an engineer. So unless there's something in there that catches somebody's eyes, I move for approval.
I'll second.
Any further discussion? With that, I'll entertain a motion to approve. Or sorry, I'll take a vote to approve. All in favor of approving the minutes.
There you go.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right, the motion passes. Next will be to review upcoming events. Victoria.
Good afternoon. Yesterday on March 4th, there was a county council meeting for the road vacation right of way for a portion of Northeast 45th Avenue and then Clark County Code Chapter 36, telecommunications and meetings. On Wednesday, March 5th, yesterday, there was a Clark County work session for the neighborhood traffic management program, as well as a bicycle and pedestrian advisory committee annual presentation. For the Planning Commission work session upcoming this evening, March 6th at 5:30 p.m., there'll be a work session regarding the comp plan policy for the rural and natural resource element, Chapter 3, and comp plan policy for parks, recreation, open space elements, Chapter 7. And then I think there will be a tentative work session later in March for the DEEB members for the annual update as well, but more to come on that later in the meeting.
Thank you. Are there any member announcements?
I do, Mr. Chair. Just for members' purposes, we have yet to provide a recommendation for DEEB members, the new DEEB members. I realize that we never identified who was going to do that, but we know who we're going to recommend. So I will volunteer to put together a letter and route it through to everyone, make sure that it's all good before we send it off to Victoria to send off to Michelle. Thank you. My apologies for not our collective apologies on from the entire board for those that are still waiting to hear back from the city or the county manager on that. So they're waiting on us.
Okay. Any other member announcements? I've got a very short one. One of my other hats that I wear is on the American Institute of Architects for Washington Housing Livability and Affordability Committee. And they mainly track state legislative things that relate to development, mostly related in the legislative session. And I know that this has become a topic that we've had actually in deep meetings, just because the number of bills related to development has seemed to really increase lately. So there's a number of them that we're tracking that will probably affect projects in this area and seem to be moving through the legislature. So I thought I'd just highlight a couple of them here before we moved on. Senate Bill 5184 is a bill that will restrict parking requirements in all cities and counties to 0.5 parking spaces per unit and 1 to 1,000 square feet for commercial space. And will not allow any changes to existing parking for changes of use.
So does that mean that if that is passed, that there's a state mandate, but the counties and cities can be more restrictive than that, right?
They can't require any more than 0.5 parking spaces per dwelling unit.
So does that mean then all the codes have to be changed throughout?
Yeah, usually the way
if it passes. Okay.
Hasn't passed yet, but that one is actually, I believe, through the Senate and to the House now. But yeah, it may get revised before it's. And usually they have language that says something like, you know, at the next opportunity to update the codes or something like that. So it doesn't immediately go into effect. That's what you're questioning. There's a number of transit-oriented bills that would impact development along transit routes, which in Clark County would probably affect Highway 99 when the Vine extension goes down there. But that may be the only area in Clark County that would be directly affected by a lot of those. And then the one that is most interesting to me, House Bill 1353, would allow architects to self-certify ADUs. So
what?
To self-certify ADUs.
Oh. What number was that?
House Bill 1353.
One thing I'll add in regards to the parking that was noted is that builders, developers have the option to, it's not a limitation on parking as far as you can add more parking if you choose to, but jurisdictions are not able to require more than that.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, the idea is that if a developer feels that for reasons of marketability, they need more parking, they can provide it. It's just, yeah, it's just, that's the jurisdictions can't require more than that.
So then there would, if it passes, there wouldn't be any minimum parking. Would there also not be any maximum parking?
This bill doesn't address that.
Because we've run into that in some jurisdictions. For some reason, they have maximum parking requirements, Portland, which really limits the uses that you can get on site.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's not part of this bill. Yeah, nothing like that. All righty.
Thank you. It's very informative.
Yeah. We'll continue to track those. And I think this is a long legislative session, I believe. So it's going to go to June, probably. April or June. End of April. Yeah.
Ryan, I had two.
Topic for
one of our other meetings once it gets closer. There's going to be a lot of these bills that drop.
Yeah. But
there's a whole list of them that we're following as well. So.
Oh, sorry, Terry.
I was just going to note in regards to bills, there's also one related to there's a condo law for 12 units. I don't know that really any it. I don't know that how it would impact code specifically, but I guess it's just good for staff to be aware of in case maybe there are impacts. But that would basically it just would reduce the it reduces the requirements to something similar to what you see for single family. On how litigation can be pursued and warranty of items. And so we'll see more smaller condo projects. Well, we haven't seen any, but this would actually allow for them at 12 units or less. So just something for staff to be aware of. Again, it's through committee. I believe it's has support through the House. The Senate is the only kind of question mark. The last item I had, just maybe something for future agenda was, and I must have missed this meeting, so I apologize. There is for the plantings on the smaller lots that are required for like tree plantings. We had an issue on a subdivision where it wasn't required for the builder to get to have the landscape certifications done, and instead it got applied at the time of the warranty bond for the yep. subdivision. And the issue yep. is in this specific subdivision, we sold to like six different builders, and then now the warranty bond that was for the development then is basically then held responsible for tree plantings and individual lots for homes with builders. And so it's a really important allowance for those trees to get planted after the fact, because otherwise you just plant them, tear them out, and then plant them again. But
no.
That verification process, just making sure that that doesn't get put onto the development, because a lot of times the developer isn't necessarily the builder.
Yeah, that came up last year. Something that Diana and April worked on. And I believe it was a way to, April, correct me if I'm wrong, but to be able to, instead of having an individual landscape cert for every single lot, that you could do it kind of as a lump sum, right?
Right.
All together.
It was a request from Deeb.
Yeah.
And it was also to because how it was presented to me is we plant it because it's required mm-hmm. and then we ruin all of those plants and then the builder has mm-hmm. to replant all of it. So,
yeah.
And so that's why we switched it.
Yeah. Yeah. So most of the time, Terry, 9 times out of 10, it's just a street tree and it's easy to or a tree in the front yard. And those landscape certs are easy to do. What's a yeah. little more challenging is if it's a buffer tree that's in the backyard. But again, what Diana and I worked out, gosh, now probably 15 years or more, is that as long as you can provide, enough, like a couple of pictures, enough to show that it's on that actual lot, the certification from the landscape architect, and an exhibit that shows which lot it is. That's really all that needs to be done.
Yeah, I agree. On the I don't have a problem as a developer being able to go through and do the photography to prove out those trees being planted, or a landscape architect to go through and verify that, viewing them as well. The backyard ones are troublesome yep. To be able to verify. That one. Most importantly, I do want to retain. It's a critical one because it's just so wasteful to not have that available. I just don't know a good it's a bit difficult for me to prove out trees are planted in the rear yard on homes that are closed on homes that I didn't build. That's my struggle. So
they shouldn't have occupancy, right? They shouldn't
have occupancy. Yeah, it should be before occupancy, but
Agreed, but they did. They got occupancy. That's my problem.
And that's a whole, I don't know.
A drone.
What's that?
We said drone. Yeah.
I mean, I could. If that's acceptable, yeah. I can do that.
Oh,
but then I can just drone the subdivision at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. I've run into that way back before drones existed, and I told them, I'm like, we can't go into people's backyards. This should have been done before occupancy was granted anyway. And then the other part of that is that the inspectors don't necessarily know that. I suggested way back when, put a note on their inspection cards or something like that. Say, is there a tree, you know, tree requirement? If that's the case now, it should not be an issue. It was not the case then, so it was an issue. So I think that this is an easy hurdle to get over, Terry. The whole point of this was to make it easier on the development community so that they didn't have to kill trees in order to build the house, because before we had to have all the buffer plantings done before they even approved the subdivision and recorded the plat. So what Diana and I came up with years ago, and now, you know, they've kind of expanded on it. The only thing I could suggest in that regard is to just pay attention, advise the builder or whatever. And then from the county side, that they just need to make sure that they check to see if that box is checked. And if it's not checked, that they get someone out there to make sure that the trees are planted.
Yeah. So I totally agree. I think my problem on this specific circumstance is 321 lot subdivision, two homes were given occupancies that don't have trees in the backyard that we verified with a drone. And then I have a warranty bond that then is getting held up over two trees that I can't, were not homes that I built. And so then I'm kind of stuck. So that's my problem at the current moment.
Terry, do you have an HOA in that subdivision?
Yep.
Most of the HOA docs have a provision for backyard inspection, so you might be able to use that for the trees as well.
Yeah, no, and I'm good with the drone footage. It's just when they don't have a tree, now all of a sudden I need to force them to allow me to plant a tree. That's my problem for my warranty bond.
Or the inspector.
But I agree, if it's taken care of with occupancy, and it was supposed to, but in this case it didn't. But if it is, then the issue isn't an issue. So I don't mean to take up all of our time. We can move on. But that is a, I guess.
There is something on the inspection card, though, that talks about that, isn't there?
There should be a hold on occupancy. Somehow it was let go, or they did, or they missed two out of 321.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's a pretty small percentage.
I don't care. I just want my warranty bond to be released, the tree, is what I care about.
Which happens.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But he's right. I mean, it's a requirement of the plat, and so we can't release it without verification. And I have to.
So that's the problem, though, right? Like, there needs to, if I don't have an issue with any of that, April, but to hold up a warranty bond over two houses that I can't control, like, that doesn't also seem, that burden seems a bit, I don't know. What am I supposed to do?
I understand the predicament, but the problem too is that was the agreement with moving it forward. And I don't know, we have to require it, and that's what the performance bond is for. I'm working through it in my head as I'm talking.
Uh-huh.
That's a hard one.
Yeah, it is.
Because I don't want to hold your performance bond for two trees, but we have to, because where's the line? Is it two? Is it 10? Is it 14?
Mm-hmm.
Let me think through this one.
She'll get back to you.
Okay.
We're going to move on. All right. Next on the agenda is biannual code updates. It's April and Brent, is that you taking this one?
Yeah. Yes. Give Shannon a second to get the presentation up. So this is more or less the same batch of biannual code amendments I came to you with in October of last year. We've made a few additions. So I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on most of it, but I'll just quickly run through the presentation. Okay.
Yeah, we didn't even see any code in here, so I'm just curious as to what.
There was a package. I'll make sure it gets out to you.
Okay.
Should have been included, but I'll check on that.
Okay.
Okay. So just this, I don't really need to spend time on background. You all know what the biennial code amendments are about. So next slide, please. Just in terms of process, we did have a work session with council February 19th with we've actually added a couple of things. One in response to that work session. Another one is just a late request. So we may end up having to go back to council depending on whether or not they have particular interest in anything that will change by that point. So I'm here today to present them again to you, and then we'll get our 60-day notice to commerce started, get the ordinances drafted, and go through the legal review process, and then actually do have a planning commission hearing scheduled for May 15th, with a work session on April 17th. They're scheduling, I wasn't able to do the back-to-back that normally occurs. And so I don't have a firm hearing date for council yet, but we're shooting for mid-June. Next slide, please. Okay, so just an overview of the non-policy changes. Just some general edits in Title 32 to address gender references, particularly to the hearings examiner or the responsible official. In addition, that title still refers to the county commission, so we're correcting that. For Title 40, a minor change to our Type 2, Type 3 timelines for application holds in response to the new changes in state law, and I'll actually touch on that in the next presentation. Updating the time limit for the county to expend impact fee revenue, consistent with state law. Our current code still has a 6-year time limit, but state law allows 10 years. One thing that is new since the last time I brought this forward is we have several changes to the urban ADU standards, because we found that even with the code update that occurred, there were some inconsistencies with state law. I think there was just a disconnect there because they were started their process in front of the changes to state law. I can go through those in a little more detail if you're interested. Still planning to clarify the language regarding the number of townhomes that can be in a low density development. And then one that was recently added is a clarification to the requirements for the student factor component of the school impact fee calculation methodology, just providing some flexibility for alternate methods that school districts may want to use when they do that. Next slide, please. In terms of the minor policy changes, we still have the rural light and glare language that you discussed last time, updates to the forest practice code, an allowance in the temporary hardship standards to allow use of an existing structure. So in the case where someone is building a new home and they need a hardship, we can allow them to use the old home for their hardship instead of having to demolish it or decommission it and bring in a manufactured home.
Does that then require going through, because I've gotten at least one, if not more, temporary hardships approved, it's the same process then for that?
It would just be we would be able to approve that permanent structure, use of that permanent structure, with a covenant that basically says it'll be decommissioned when the hardship no longer applies. We still have a change to for the off-street parking that's now required with I believe it's in the narrow lot standards. Anyway, the guest parking, When it's off street, we've had a few cases where that parking has essentially been abutting the right of way, directly connected to the public road or private road, as a head in parking. And we had some sidewalk proposals where the sidewalk was between the parking and the road. And so we're just proposing to require that sidewalk to go around the parking. And then a late fee for overdue fire marshal invoices for the annual inspections that they do, because they do those inspections, then they bill the business, and currently there's no penalty for not paying that invoice on time. Next slide, please. Just a little more detail on the changes to the forest practice ordinance. So I'm going to hand it over to Kevin Tyler and Hunter Decker.
Afternoon, Kevin Tyler, Clark County Public Works, and our county forester here, Hunter Decker's here with us. So Hunter and I have been reviewing the forest practice ordinance over the past several years against, other sections of Title 40, the county's critical areas ordinance, and then especially the forest practice revised code of Washington, which is 7609, and then Washington Administrative Code, in particular sections relating to forest land conversions. And we've determined that there's some need to update the code to be consistent with some of these, primarily with state laws, but also with county code. If you can go to the next slide, please. And so these are some of the high-level changes that we're proposing. One is we have a class one forest practice. There are certain situations where the state doesn't require permits for class one forest practices, but the county code does allow for class one forest practice permits. And we've always had provision, or we've always had requirements for class one in certain situations. And but there were very limited provisions about the issuance of those permits. So we're adding some sections in the code about those provisions. As I mentioned, we're updating the code language so it's consistent with state level forest practice codes. We're developing a clear list of exemptions from permit requirements, so when we don't need to issue a forest practice permit, updating some of the provisions for what we call conversion permits. Those are class four general forest practices, and conversion option harvest plans, which very rarely come up. I think we've had one in the last couple decades, so not very often at all. And then a slight change to Title VI regarding fees, where we're consolidating the class one forest practice permit and site inspection fees. Hunter, is there anything else you wanted to add about this?
I can't think of anything. If you have any questions or need some more clarification, be happy to help assist.
I had a question about the conversion option harvest plan. I actually was involved with a short plat that utilized that, and part of the vesting was what made it beneficial to develop under that because of the zone change. So I see that the timeline is changing from 10 years to 2 years. What's, I guess, the reason behind that? Because it kind of pulls away what I understood was kind of one of the main factors of why you would use that.
Yeah, so that change comes about because of needing to be consistent with Title 40 and vesting requirements in Title 40. We don't want to create a situation where we allow for vesting of, like a conversion situation that would then be in conflict with development engineering, stormwater, et cetera, other requirements. So that was one of the reasons. Hunter, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, and there's other county jurisdictions in the state that have it as 2 years as well.
All right. So actually, this last slide's a holdover from council work session. So there's really nothing here on that. So if you want, I can go through the ADU changes.
I seem to remember this now. Wasn't this the fall biannual code amendment?
It was. And then we had to pause it. So
okay.
Yeah. And so yeah, we're just renaming it to spring because we're picking it up again, and it's now 2025. So.
Okay. Can you, before you get into the ADU, can you go back and explain the type 2 and 3 timelines for application holds under state law and what exactly that is? We've just recently received some early issues letters, and I just want to get an understanding as far as what the county can and can't do now under this new state law.
So that's actually the next item on the agenda.
Perfect. Okay. Never mind. Bobby dipped. Look at there.
Okay. So the changes to the ADU standards, apologize for you not getting the code update packet. So let me make sure I'm looking.
Yeah, yeah. I believe we've all reviewed this and provided our recommendations previously. Yeah. So this just, yeah.
That it was back in October.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I brought that up.
You didn't have an issue?
No.
It was on September 5th.
Yeah. So, so the first item is just making sure that our definition of ADU is consistent with the definition in state statute. Which the state definition allows ADUs to not only be accessory to a detached single family dwelling, but to duplex, triplex, townhome, or other housing unit. So it's very broad. And I mean, technically, we can get through some of these other changes, but there we could theoretically see a scenario on a multifamily property where somebody requests an ADU to be accessory to one of the units in each lot if it's a multi-lot development. That's what the statute says. And, you know, like the proposed parking standards, these are limitations on what we can require. So it's not that we can be more restrictive. These basically tell us that we cannot be more restrictive. So the next change to the use table in the residential and office residential districts, the multifamily and districts. We are changing in that use table, ADUs are listed as a review and approval, and we're changing them to permitted. Then let's see the next one. In the applicability language and the ADU standards, the urban ADU standards, we're basically making that consistent with the state statute requirement, which says that we have to allow ADUs in any district that allows for single family homes. So that means even in some of our like commercials in the commercial zones where we allow existing single family residences, if they want an ADU, they can have an ADU.
If they already have a single family.
Yes. Residence. Okay. But, you know, in the multifamily, some of the multifamily districts, we do allow new single family homes. Mm-hmm. And so, in those cases, you could also do ADUs.
You're saying that it would apply in pre-existing non-conforming situations as well?
If the district explicitly allows, so for instance, in our commercial districts, we have a line item in our use table that says existing single family residences.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, next one. Just clarifying our language regarding the fact that state statute says we have to allow 2 ADUs. Our current code isn't clear that both of those ADUs can be separate detached structures, but the state statute is clear on that. So we're just clarifying that. So you can do two attached ADUs, one attached, one detached, two ADUs in one structure, two ADUs in two separate structures. And that's pretty much the changes for ADUs.
I'm just curious as far as how the sewer district would comment on if there are any sanitary sewer issues associated with connections to the existing lateral with two additional residences.
There could be an upgrade, but most of the time, the lateral, I mean, it's usually the same lateral size if you have like a 6-bedroom house versus a 2-bedroom.
Okay.
So it's probably not going to have a huge impact.
Okay.
But in some cases, you might have to upgrade your lateral.
Right.
I think the bigger issue that I've heard from customers is their house is on septic, but sewer is 200 feet away. So to have an ADU, they have to pull it. And they've got to pull it to their other property line.
And they wouldn't qualify for a sewer waiver.
Not unless there's a mountain in the way.
Well, isn't the sewer waiver 300?
It's 300.
It's 300. Yeah.
700 for water, I think.
But this isn't the land division, and sewer waivers are, you can't get a sewer waiver for a land division. But since this is the land division, then technically, if it's more than 300 feet away, you could get a sewer waiver. But then you'd have to upgrade your septic.
The sewer waiver is very specific about what is allowed, and financial issues are not. It's really if there is a mountain in the way,
right,
or a river.
Yeah.
All right. Any more questions about the biennial code updates?
What do you need from us?
Well, I'll send you guys the actual language, code language, and if you have any suggestions or any concerns about any of the proposed items, I would definitely like to have that probably, hopefully, prior to April 17th, which is our work session with Planning Commission.
No problem.
Yep.
Yeah.
This seemed pretty non-controversial this time. This seemed pretty cut and dry.
Yeah. Send it out, and then maybe at our next meeting, since it will be in advance of that, we can then provide a recommendation for you for council.
Right.
Okay. So if we want to, Victoria, put that on our next meeting to provide a recommendation on the spring biannual code updates.
All right.
Yeah, go ahead and jump right in.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, and the next item just is regard to the timelines for review, and that ties into the lien work we did with the state auditor's office on our Type 3 process. I don't know, I had prepared a memo, and there was a flow chart with that. I don't know if everybody got that or was able to, it's not very, unfortunately, it's not very printer friendly. I'll make sure you guys have that as well. The PDF is high enough resolution. You can zoom in and see everything. First thing in the memo is just going over kind of a summary of what the statute says with regard to timelines. The first item, there's no changes to the requirements for fully complete review. So these changes apply to the actual review process. One thing, I'm just pointing this out, it's not really a suggestion of how we want to approach dealing with this, but we've heard from other jurisdictions that they are actually considering. The statute does not require jurisdictions to accept revisions after the application is fully complete. So in other words, the statute does not require jurisdictions to accept revisions to an application after it's fully complete. So if you want to change your application, theoretically, we would not, technically, we may not legally have to accept it under state statute. I'm not suggesting that we would take that approach.
Okay.
But we have heard from other jurisdictions that they are considering Basically, you submit it, we review it, we give you a decision.
It seems like a lot of times there's early issues, there's things that come through, and it is there's changes that come from staff comments.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of the process.
Yes. And so, and the statute does provide for that.
Yeah.
It just doesn't say that you can change your application at any time you want.
That's pretty rare, I would think, isn't it?
Well, how do you want to define changing your application? Yeah, you submit something, a new document that's a revision to something in your application. That's technically a change to it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't want to get bogged down on that now.
No.
There's more, and we'll definitely get into that. So the one other provision in there that we're not really sure exactly what it means and how it would apply, but there is language that says that there is a threshold at which revisions to your application could essentially reset the review clock if it relates to items that are fully complete requirements. So if you change something that changes your fully complete requirements, in theory, that may allow the jurisdiction to restart the review clock.
But once again, you're talking about applicant generated revisions here, yeah, right? I would think so.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And honestly, we're not clear on what exactly how that language applies. It's very worded very oddly. It talks about new uses. It talks about changes to commercial or residential elements. We don't know exactly what all that means.
Very subjective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so the next one is when the jurisdiction requests additional information, such as our early issues, that's when we make that request, the review clock stops.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's really not a big change from how we've been doing things, but now it's in state statute. One thing that has changed for us and is one of our biannual code amendments is when you resubmit in response to that request, the clock restarts. Our code says we have 14 days to review your submittal to see if it's complete.
Does your code say that or does your policy say that?
Our code says
that. Your code says that. Okay.
Yeah. And so we're taking that 14 days out of the code with this biannual code update. Okay. There's also a provision that says that if an applicant is what it defines as non-responsive for 60 days, that we can add 30 days to the clock. And the definition of non-responsive isn't just we haven't heard from you. It's it says you're not making diligent progress. So if you said I can get this in by this date and you don't make it and you don't communicate, that 30 days could kick in. An applicant can request a temporary suspension of their application review at any time in the process. So that's basically an applicant requested hold. What the statute says is that the jurisdiction can put conditions on that. We can't deny that request, but we can put conditions on it. That's what it says. And it doesn't tell us what that means.
Like a timeline or?
Well, timelines, yes, timelines. And I'll talk more about it as well. We're also looking at in certain cases, asking that you give us additional review time once you resubmit. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that request has to be in writing.
Yes. These requests have to be
email, in writing. Right? Hey.
Yeah.
That's how it's been in the past. So, okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, getting a phone call, hey, I want to put my application on hold. We need it in writing. The state mandated deadlines for our type 1 reviews is 65 days. Our code is still 21 days. We're not proposing to change that. Type 2 timeline in statute is 100 days. We're at 78. And on the type 3 timeline is 170 days. Our code is 92. For reporting purposes with Department of Commerce, because we're required now to report annually on deadline performance for applications that relate to residential development. We are held to our timelines, not the state timelines. So we're reporting against our adopted timelines. So again, that's one of the other reasons that we're taking the 14 days out of our code, because theoretically we could stay within state timeline, maybe with one or two rounds of that. But if we go beyond that, we would get sideways with the state limit. Okay, so that's basically an overview of what's in the new statute. So in terms of what we're proposing or what we're considering, and this is draft, we certainly want Deeb's feedback on this. This is basically just internal work at this point, so we haven't had any external feedback yet. So we're going to continue to do early issues, and that's an information request. We are considering doing it essentially one round of early issues. Instead of, because we've had projects that have 5-6 rounds, and we often find that often the issues aren't getting addressed in the first submittal or the second submittal. And so we're considering just essentially making that request on our side once.
And if you make it once then, and if it's not addressed, then is it a situation where you recommend a denial or you deny an application because of the lack of information provided based on the issues?
If it's not something that we can condition.
Okay.
As an applicant, you still have the opportunity to request a hold if you realize you need to address something.
Right.
I don't think we're going to. If we see fatal flaws, we're not going to not communicate that, mm-hmm. but we're not going to issue a formal written request for additional information.
Gotcha. Okay.
So we aren't changing the language in our early issues memo where we essentially give you 14 days to respond. Now that response, if it's easy, could be your submittal to address all the issues. It could be a response to say, I need to put my application on hold. Perfect. To have more time to address these issues.
And that's pretty much the way it is now, right?
It is. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But that request is going to have to be in writing. Yep. We're going to have to be more diligent about any deadlines that we agree to, not letting it go past and not communicating and trying to figure out. So we can always, if we agree, like say you say I need 30 days. So the 30 days gets close, you can say, hey, wait a minute, I need more time. We could get into that 60-day non-responsive discussion at some point, but we're always going to be open to whatever time you need, as long as it's not years. That's one of the situations, because we haven't been diligent on our side. We do have cases that have been sitting on the shelf for a few years that we just need to. Yeah. So.
No, I think what happens is communications, like, significant, because you get someone from out of town who is not used to working in this jurisdiction. They don't know that they have to send that email putting it on hold. So it just kind of, like, things just kind of go, and you don't have good responsiveness back and forth. And, see that with, like, smaller architects from Portland that are trying to do work over here. And, we got called in just to do a road mod because it came up in early issues. And the road mods significant for a small little project, and that's when we see these happen. We had one that was didn't think we'd ever have to get involved in it. It's a small business permit, but they got conditioned to do arterial frontage improvements for a 300-foot bedroom expansion on a existing use. So there was no way around it, so this is, it's being put on hold to go through that, and it seems like the road mod committee and how that interacts with the early issues and the application process is something we may need to look at, because most of the time when we have these big holds, it's somehow related to the road mod committee.
Yeah, and I believe Melanie is planning to come next month to talk about the road mod committee and the process for that. So one of the other things we're considering is that road modification requests that are submitted after fully complete require a suspension request as well.
As a part of the early issues.
Yes.
A road mod is identified during the early issues review as being required that wasn't identified earlier on or in the pre-app or something like
right.
that.
And wasn't in your application.
Right.
If it was in your narrative and we missed it, you know, in the fully complete review, and we're, you know, that's a different scenario. But so we're basically saying that requires a suspension of your application because it takes at least 21 days to get through that process. So in terms of those suspension requests, we're going to be asking you to provide a timeline when you request additional time. So we have a proposal of how much time you have. Yeah. So then the other, so one of the other things that we run into in a lot of cases is we get, whether it's because of multiple rounds of early issues, you know, whatever reason, we get significant revisions very late in the process. We've already, you know, our reviewers are providing their input for the staff report several weeks before, two or three weeks before the staff report's actually due out. They've already done their work, and then we get late revisions. So what we're basically saying is, if you aren't going to agree to suspend your application to have us look at those revisions, we may not consider them in the decision. They still could be part of the record. Obviously, if it's a type 3 process, they're going to get considered, but they may not, you know, we may be recommending denial in our staff report, and either going to the hearing, suggesting a continuance, or knowing that we're going to be dealing with those things in an open record. You know, certainly, and obviously this is all has to do with the degree of revisions, the complexity. Often there's very simple things that don't need to hold up the process. So we're still going to have to use our judgment on that. But in terms of conditioning those suspension requests and adding additional days for us to review those revisions, what we're proposing is, if you're going beyond the 14 days for early issues, we're going to ask for another 14 days to review what you submit. At early issues, yeah, you have 14 days to respond. If you get your submittal, if you submit everything that you need to within the 14 days, the clock doesn't stop, right? I shouldn't say the clock doesn't stop.
It starts
up immediately when you submit.
Right.
What we're saying is, if you request additional time beyond the 14 days, okay, we're going to ask you to give us an additional 14 days to review what you submit. This is a proposal, which is open for discussion. If it's a road mod request, we're going to ask for 21 days.
Sorry.
If you need more than 60 days, we've suggested that we would like to add 30 days to the process.
You're going to send us that. You're going to.
Yes.
Like, okay, good.
Yes. And along with that, if you trigger the state 30-day extension, we're not going to double up on that because you're more than 60 days. So, you know, that 30 days is open for discussion. And then we're also suggesting that if you're submitting revisions within 30 days of the decision or the staff report due date, that we are going to ask for an additional 30 days to deal with that. Again, there's some judgment. If it's for simple, we might have cases where we technically add that 30 days to the clock, but we don't use it all. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of what we're going to have to start being conscientious of, is if we can get it done, let's get it done, regardless of what the clock says. And, you know, again, we're now on the hook to report our performance to the state on this stuff. And so, you know, this is kind of a statute that has an element of be careful what you ask for, because it ties our hands in terms of being able to be flexible, because we're now going to be reporting our performance to the state, and theoretically there's some kind of oversight. And so we need to be diligent about the communication, the documentation, which is more work. we don't want to get backed into a corner by an applicant that abuses the process. And, you know, we're forced to issue a decision before we're really ready to do so. Okay. What? There's more. And that these are, we've had some applicants that want to revise their application, but don't really want to give us time to address it. So we're basically saying if you submit revisions unrequested, and you don't want to agree to additional time for review, we may not consider it. Next item, we do anticipate that we may be doing a few more denials because of the scheduling, particularly for those applicants that want to argue about issues and we can't get to a resolution and then they want to move forward. We've had a lot of cases, and it's not anybody in this room, but where it's like, okay, I'm just going to move forward. We'll argue to the hearings examiner, we'll deal with it on appeal, and then a week before the decision, I've changed my mind, I'm going to make those revisions. We don't want to incentivize that. All right, so with the possibility of more denials, we are considering creating a post-decision review pathway for denials. So if we do deny something on a issue that can be resolved with a revision to the application, if we did this, there'd be an opportunity to essentially apply to revise your application after decision. We're thinking it should be open for a limited time window, and it should be limited to revisions. So if it's an argument about the code or how we've applied the code, that still has to be an appeal. But if it's just, hey, I can fix this and get to an approval, that's what it would be for. So I'd certainly appreciate some feedback on that idea.
Yeah, when you send this out, because that's a huge departure from what is been the standard for a long time.
Well, and yeah, I'll be honest, I'm concerned that you're just something's going to get denied over some small issue that's easy to fix, but
threat of the fact that you can't reapply for the same application in a certain amount of time.
What the code says is that if we deny the application, unless we've denied it without prejudice, that's a statement we actually have to put in the decision. We have to conscientiously say we're denying this without prejudice. If we deny it with prejudice, which is the default, you cannot reapply for a year.
Right. And see, that's what gets people to get things resolved during their application process.
Yes. But at the same time, those for type two. I mean, this we're talking about, this would be for type one and type two decisions. Type three decisions go to Superior Court.
All right.
And those are de novo appeal process. You can theoretically revise your application to comply with the code, and we could agree to revise our decision and you could withdraw your appeal. And I would rather have a post-decision review process to do that, where we're getting paid the correct fee instead of somebody abusing our appeal process that way. So we may decide that it's not going to work, but we're definitely looking at it.
Better yet, wouldn't it be better just to like put it on hold? If it's a type two, it's administrative anyway. So we do a hold.
Yes.
And then we
we're not saying that we would just go out and be out denying. We're still letting you suspend your application. We're still trying to work through it and get to approval. But this is for those, and maybe we shouldn't, you know, this is for those applicants that are standing on a principle that then they reconsider once they get their denial.
Sounds like what an architect would do.
Which, you know, we've
stand on principle.
We've had some cases where it's fixable. We know it's fixable, but we can't condition it. And so we have to deny it. And, you know, I had a couple inquiries from those applicants who have changed consultants and now are finding they have to wait a year to reapply. So. And then the last thing is specifically about the lien work we did with the auditor's office last fall, which is this that you'll get a copy of, which is basically our type three process. And really the primary recommendation that came out of that was that we should be streamlining our communication both internally and externally and try to get away from relying on email as a primary vehicle for communicating about early issues, revisions. So what we're looking at doing is utilizing.
Before you tell us that, why would they say that? What is their reasoning behind getting away from email as a primary communication?
I think April would like to.
I know. when you're making revisions with your land use planner, sometimes that doesn't get communicated to development engineering, and or you're making revisions with development engineering and it doesn't get back to the planner, because you're having just one-on-one emails and there are more people involved with the decision and the timing.
Okay.
So you make revisions with you're talking to the engineer and making revisions, and even requesting longer time. And the land use planner doesn't know. And we find out 2 days before something is due.
Okay.
Yeah. So like I said, this is internal and external.
Okay. I want to hear then the rest of it.
Okay. So we have functionality in our LMS system that we use internally for fully complete and for early issues comments, but we can use that externally. It's a call to referral. We would essentially send the applicant a referral, which has a deadline. We can attach documents to it. It opens a web portal where you can the recipients can respond. They can upload documents, and then it also interacts with the reporting functions and the clock functions in LMS. So if we pushed out a referral to you, it would push the case into a status that would essentially be applicant time, and the system keeps track of jurisdiction time and applicant time, so it can help us with our reporting. And then it has a clear in the system record of that communication, both out and in, when it was sent out, when it was returned. We did sort of a proof of concept level testing with it, and So we still have to go through some configuration and some testing to make sure it's really going to work. And then in conjunction with that, we think we can reopen the submittal portal so your documents, your revisions can be uploaded into LMS instead of being sent to somebody as an email.
Can that be applicant initiated communication?
No.
Okay. Sorry. We would still have to email you, but then it would be.
Yeah. So if you request a suspension, you would email us. Then what we would do is we would create a referral, send it out to you with the deadline we've agreed to.
Gotcha.
So that we would know when you respond.
Okay.
Development engineering uses the LMS this way today. So it's just aligning land use with development engineering to use it in the exact same way.
So is it mostly your internal processes that affect the applicant too much? Because it sounds like the applicant would have or the county would have a case manager, and the applicant would email the case manager, and they would make sure that it gets entered into your system, that portal, and then gets distributed to whoever needs it internally.
Right. Development engineering and land use, and then and anyone else who would need to would be able to go on LMS and see all the communication.
So we can still communicate with you guys by email, but then you're going to, once it goes by email, you're going to put it into your system internally so it gets
right, but tracked. But we can push a referral out to you once you've requested a suspension, or when we issue early issues, it'll come to you as a referral, and it'll have a deadline, it'll allow you to respond through a web portal with written comments or uploaded documents. We're still going to want you to submit your revisions into the document submittal portal. I don't have a firm timeline on when we're going to be able to roll this out, but
we're running a little short on time.
Yeah. I want to make this an agenda at our next, because I've already generated a bunch of questions myself.
Okay. Can you come back next month with the same thing?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, because I think there's a lot of important stuff, and this is really one of the kind of key issues, functions of DEEB, I feel like. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, and just so you're aware, we're still not getting clear messages from Commerce on how the reporting is going to work. They pushed a draft for 2024, and it's just been nothing but confusion. So
if I could ask you to maybe send out a lot of these changes,
I have a memo that intended to have you have today, as well as this.
Yeah.
If you could send that out. I will get that with you.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I see that we have 35 minutes scheduled for the stormwater code and manual updates. I at least ask the question as to whether or not this is something that could be moved to the next agenda, or does do you? Okay.
Yeah, we've had people waiting. I would say
let's go
session discussion. Our internal stuff, we bump that instead. I know we still have to talk about that, but we may be able to do that more email. But since people have been waiting.
Yep, I agree.
But I also agree. I know that we rushed her last time. And so if she can't fit it all in this time, then maybe it makes sense to bump it.
I'm not sure that Haley and Aldrich is going to be able to come back next time. So I'd like to get through our topic today.
Let's go ahead. Thank you for your patience, by the way.
Yeah. No problem. Okay. And Devin, did you want to talk at all, or should we just launch?
Let's just jump right into it since we're short on time. Thank you, Trista.
All right. And is it okay if we go to 3:25 or even the end of the meeting, or do we need to hold time for public comment?
We can it doesn't have to end right at 3:30.
I'm not sure if Dan and Luke can stay. Okay, so yeah, Clark County Stormwater Code and Manual update. You've heard about this before, so I'm going to skip all of the introductory material. This is our second batch of basically discretionary changes that we're bringing in front of you. The updates that have been requested either by county staff or the community. And these are topically related, and they're all about geotechnical investigations. So that's our discussion today. And I'm going to skip all this overview stuff. These will affect text in book one and book two. I believe you got a handout that has a black line of proposed updates that we want to discuss today. And they're essentially in four topics: clarifying the subsurface characterization requirements in book one, updating infiltration rate correction factors, also in book one of the Clark County Stormwater Manual, updating our closed depression analysis requirements in book two, and updating groundwater mounding analysis requirements also in book two. So I'm going to turn it over to Dan to talk, and I'm going to display the black line proposed edits, and Dan from Haley and Aldrich is going to review them.
Perfect. Yeah, and thank you, Trista. And like Trista said, these are four topics, but honestly, they're pretty interrelated and probably infiltration and mounding analysis is really how they're lumped in. Just in the interest of time, we'll kind of won't read things verbatim to you because you also have them there, but we'll describe the intent. So Chapter 4 flow control has the site characterization study requirements, and we have some simple clarifications that in the subsurface characterization, right now it says it just says subsurface explorations for site characterization, and we've added the and or infiltration tests. And that's actually in when you have minimum requirements 1 through 5, the soils report, that's for that. It actually says infiltration tests. So we're just tying that in. So there's a certain number of infiltration tests that are recommended or that are required. Items D and E just really cross-reference some other sections that have some requirements about the number of tests that are supposed to be done. The note, we wanted to recognize that as a geotechnical engineer and most of my geotechnical engineer colleagues out there, we rarely actually meet the requirements that are already in the manual for the number of tests that need to be completed. And that's because we don't know what the systems are. You know, it says you have to have one exploration for every 200 feet of infiltration trench. Well, when we're doing our geotechnical study, we honestly typically don't know what the systems are going to be. So added a little bit more language that's saying, make reasonable attempts to do your work where systems are going to be in the future, and then provide written justification that if you didn't do all these tests right where all the systems are going to go, which is going to be most cases, honestly, just provide some written justification about why your work is reasonable and appropriate. The county staff are more keyed into infiltration issues just broadly, and so they're going to be paying more attention to the submittals. There is the last sentence does specifically state supplemental explorations and/or testing may be required by the responsible official. They deem that the quantity and or locations of exploration infiltration tests are inadequate or non-representative conditions at or below the proposed infiltration systems. And that's primarily going to be if someone does a wholly inadequate geotech report and tries to justify, hey, we did one infiltration test and we're using it for a large development conceptually. So mostly that's clarifying and being a little more explicit that we understand that there may need to be some flexibility. Scroll down, Trista. Probably the biggest change in this section is about the correction factors. The right now, Clark County, the manual for geotechnical study, for infiltration study, basically has a minimum correction factor of 4. There's the base correction factor of 2, and then there's a minimum soils correction factor of 2. And then there are the additive system design correction factors. The county's pretty much the only one who has it. Vancouver just has the base correction factor, and the soils correction factor is a minimum value of 0. We are recommending changing to the correction factors that are provided in the Western Washington Stormwater Manual that recognizes the different sorts of field testing that is completed. And so there are different correction factors if you do a large-scale pit, a pilot infiltration test, 0.75. So these are multiplicative correction factors in this case as opposed to the additive. Or if you're doing the grain size analysis, we have a carryover from the 2019 Western Washington Stormwater Manual that is not in the 2024, which is that other small-scale test. That's because the ASCE falling head test would meet that criteria of a small scale test, which is allowed by Clark County and Vancouver and others, but not explicitly in the ecology manual. So we carried that over. But otherwise, these correction factors are what are in Western Washington Stormwater Manual. And so this table's basically straight from there. Scroll down. Oh, I will say, the first correction factor, scroll back up just for a second, Trista. Site variability or number of locations tested is between 0.33 and 1. Well, most geotechnical engineers are going to say, hey, we will use 1. Well, we do add an asterisk there that you can only use the value of 1 if you've met the requirements that were in the site characterization report for the number of tests based on your systems. So if you don't meet those requirements specifically, the maximum value is 0.9. The next little bit of language is just converting those multiplicative correction factors into more of the equivalent factor of safety. It's just inverse of the multiplication. And then the system correction factors have stayed the same. They're the additive correction factors, and we just pull them into a separate table. And the next language is just add the infiltration correction factor and the system correction factors. The next page, this isn't in the handout you got. I just wanted to quickly show where we would end up with, what's your infiltration correction factors would end up with, assuming you had no system correction factors. Typical, if you did a full scale pilot infiltration test, you generally uniform site conditions and your infiltration trenches serve less than an acre. I'm not going to go through the numbers and the math, but you would end up with 1.65. So essentially a factor of safety of 1.65 instead of a factor of safety of 4. Let's say you did the ASC falling head test. That's the next example. You'd end up with a factor of safety of 3.1 instead of 4. But obviously it's greater than the 1.65. Now, if you just did grain size correlations and you did a really poor job of characterizing the site because maybe you just did 2 tests and they were variable, and so you had a correction factor of 0.5 instead of 0.9, you would end up with a correction factor there of 5.6. So you could end up with a factor of safety greater than 4, but with any what I would consider reasonably planned and executed geotech investigation, you will generally end up with correction factors less than 4 that are currently there. Moving on.
We're moving on to book 2.
Now we go to book 2.
Oh,
yeah.
Apparently not. That's what I'm hearing.
Because they've been sitting.
Oh,
yeah.
Means the safety.
Are you not able to hear us?
We can hear you.
Okay. We're at book 2, chapter 1, and hydrologic computation and analysis.
Yeah, and so here there's a little bit of a little bit added to the closed depression analysis. Can you zoom in a little bit, Trista?
Oh, sorry. Yes.
Here So minor clarification on that second sentence for closed depressions that currently contain or historically have contained standing water. Previously it just said containing standing water. We put in an explicit recommendation to review the county's 1996 infrared flood imagery to see as one way to identify standing water, just because that isn't always done. Then we are adding probably the biggest change here is that next, that last sentence. If the seasonal high groundwater table is determined to be less than 15 feet from the from a proposed infiltration facility bottom, then groundwater mounding analysis shall be completed in accordance with section 5.1.2. So basically, if you have a, if you're putting an infiltration system in a closed depression and the groundwater, seasonal high groundwater is less than 15 feet from the bottom of the system, we want mounding analysis done. And then that segues into some of the changes to the mounding analysis. The current mounding analysis is generally done. That first bullet is the depth to seasonal high groundwater or low permeability soil stratum is less than 5 feet from the infiltration facility bottom is what is currently in the manual, proposing a change to 10 feet. The next bullet is if the system is drained, the contributing runoff area is greater than 1 acre, and the depth to groundwater, previously it just said the depth to groundwater or the permeable stratum is less than 15 feet. Didn't clarify that it's 15 feet from the infiltration facility bottom. So we're clarifying that. That's not 15 feet from the ground surface, but 15 feet below the facility bottom. The next bullet, the new bullet, is just cross-referencing the closed depression analysis. If you have groundwater within 15 feet of the base of a facility in a closed depression, we want mounding analysis. And then a statement, the responsible official may require groundwater mounding analysis when the potential for mounding to adversely affect the proposed performance of the proposed infiltration systems can be inferred from site conditions. The last sentence is, there's really no clarity currently on, it just says do mounding analysis. It doesn't say what the result is supposed to be. And so this is saying that your mounding analysis shall demonstrate that the groundwater does not mound above the bottom of the infiltration facility at any point during the continuous flow model. So basically, we don't want the groundwater to back up into your infiltration system, is what the mounding analysis needs to demonstrate. Those are the key changes we're presenting. And you can use your 5 minutes for questions or more, or
yeah, we can take questions. I will also say that we can leave these with you. I believe you have them, and we can accept your comments for the next couple of weeks by emailing them to Rod Swanson. Say hi, Rod. He's in the room.
I do have a few quick ones.
Yeah.
If I can squeeze them in. So we had this coefficient of permeability before, kind of for that safety factor for the double ring and falling head. Is that still there? Or is that just replaced by the 0.4?
There was no the safety factor of 2 and that goes away. So it's the 0.4 now. Before there was the base correction factor of 2. And then a soils correction factor of 2 that were additive to give you a minimum factor of safety of 4. Those have gone away, and now we are and that's why now they're a multiplicative correction factor that you invert. And so that's why I showed those examples that they would generally be below 4.
Okay. And then to get to the groundwater mounding analysis, mm-hmm. the 15 feet, What does the manual require? Because that seems like it's more stringent than what the manual requires.
Now, the manual currently requires 15 feet if if your infiltration facility is draining more than 1 acre drainage basin. So that's in the manual, that's in Western Washington, that's in King County. The clarification that we added to that specific bullet is that it's 15 feet from the bottom of the facility, not 15 feet below the ground surface.
Oh, okay. That's how I think it's been applied either way. It's from the bottom of the surface.
Yeah. Right now, it just doesn't say, it just says 15 feet. So that was the clarification on that specific bullet. And then we use that.
It hasn't always
same...
been interpreted that way.
Yeah.
We've interpreted it that way.
Some have interpreted that as being a below ground surface.
That wouldn't make sense. And then the big one I see, really, the groundwater analysis, so demonstrate the groundwater does not mound above the bottom of the infiltration facility. So what if it does? Are we basically saying that area is undevelopable because there's no out? So in that situation where it goes above the surface, and we're going to have this, I mean, if something like this, when we're up in battleground, that could potentially make all of battleground undevelopable. So it's a big wholesale change because normally it can still function. You might have a little backup. You should show like some head in the system, but it eventually goes out. So if this is an absolute that you must show that, there's a lot of sites. I mean, not a small amount, a lot of sites where we no longer can develop that land. We got to take them out of our comp plan. So anything with groundwater, you know, higher than 15 feet below the surface, which there's a good area, we're not gonna be able to develop those areas and meet this requirement. So I would suggest you take another look at it instead of saying that it has to. We need to show how that system is going to function when water does go into that system.
You have a backwater system.
Yes, it can't be absolute.
Makes sense.
There'd be a huge unintended consequence.
Yeah, that starts coming in to the hydraulic performance of the system beyond kind of the basic geotechnical issues. And yeah. Then whether, because yeah, there are systems that are actually designed to back up.
And that's what we'd want to do here, but this does not give that flexibility. So we want to make sure that gets addressed, you know, before this, you know, goes any further, I would say. That's a big one. And the way this code's set up, we have to get rid of water with infiltration, even if there's high groundwater. So, I mean, when we have these sites that have high groundwater, we're splitting them into small basins, because we have less separation of groundwater and we're doing LID and other, you know, smaller infiltration systems because we got to deal with that high groundwater. So we need all the tools in the box, and this would take away a big tool. So thank you.
Makes sense.
Thanks, Eric. That's great commentary.
The other thing I'll quickly throw out, just because I may not be on all the calls. We are also, as part of the work we're supporting, we're preparing basically a geotechnical checklist because the stormwater manual is written for hydraulic engineers, not for the geotechnical engineers, and the requirements for the geotechnical studies are kind of scattered all over the place and vary with whatever system's going to be designed and what the minimum requirements that are applicable are, that we're hoping will be a tool for both geotechnical engineers to use and then the county reviewers to go through, and that'll eventually make its way to this group, I would presume.
Thanks, Dan. I will just close this topic by saying again, we'd love your comments if you have any, or if you want to distribute them to your teams in your places of business. Will accept comments. These are not going to ecology anytime soon. So for the overall project process, we have a certain set of updates to the manual, the ones that are mandated by ecology and any others that we deem significant, meaning they change the way they change ACART, all known and reasonable methods of treatment and control, or the change the way the manual meets the MEP standards, maximum extent practicable. If it changes that, we need to send it to ecology by June. We don't think
these geotechnical updates meet that requirement. So these will be continue to be considered for about another year. We're not intending to adopt the manual until June of 2026. So in about 1 year from now is when the Planning Commission, Department of Commerce reviews, start going to County Council and working toward adoption. So we have plenty of time to work on the geotechnical requirements. But we will thank you for any comments that you want to submit to Rod. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, thank you so much. Really interesting presentation. I appreciate it. Appreciate your patience as well. So as discussed, we'll probably not get into the council work session discussion too much at the moment, although I do want to verify, are we on the agenda and when?
I think Victoria is waiting for us, or do you have a date?
Yeah, so I actually just spoke with the council's office right before this meeting, and she had mentioned March 19th or the 26th. Looks open.
The 26th is Oregon spring break.
I think in this case, having it a little later, because we just bumped our discussion on this topic, okay. So we need it a little bit later in the year.
Okay.
But that to the chair.
26. So we'd be looking at April's 9th or 16th, somewhere around in there.
Is all it right, possible yep. to do it in April?
Yeah.
Let me follow up with Rebecca. She knows it's I let them know that we were working to get the date today. So I'll email her right now, okay. And then I'll follow up with you via email.
I would lobby for the 9th just for my own.
Okay.
Our next meeting's on April 10th because of spring break.
That's true. We're going to have to work this out via email. Yeah. And it's going to be Sherry's and Ryan's heavy load right now.
Yeah.
And then route it out to all of us.
I think maybe the three of us should have coffee sometime or something and try to get a jump on this.
Three of them
together. you've got to at least sit there.
I already volunteered to do something else. Pick someone else to do that. What's that? No, I'm incoming chair next year. Yeah.
No, you're vice
old chair,
vice
new chair
now.
I've done this a couple times, so.
All right. To keep this moving, next on the agenda is public comment. Is there anyone from the public who would like to make any comments?
Got a brief one, Ryan.
Sure.
And I can probably handle it offline with April too. Having just some discussion with HVAC contractors and Northwest Natural about using gas in the subdivisions. But right now, we saw the revised schedule. You can't match the same points with a gas furnace that you can with an electric because of the HVAC right now. So I'm wondering if that was an oversight or further comment or questions.
I believe
you're talking about the energy code.
I believe that what they did was the negative point. Oh boy, I'm out of my element on this one. The negative points they were going to give for doing gas, they are making it flat. So it's not the same as electric. You're just not being punished for using it.
Correct. But I think if you use electric with gas supplemental, you can't get, essentially, if you're using, and I'm a little out of my element too because I'm not an HVAC guy, but I can send you the email that was drafted for me, but if you use a heat pump with no backup heat, essentially with central duct, you can get 4 points. If you use any of the gas furnaces with any of the combinations, you can only get 3, which makes it really difficult to use a gas furnace in the house because you're going to end up 1 point short and you have to do some pretty difficult items and cost prohibitive items to try to get back to a gas furnace.
I'll have Mark look at it, but also we just did a learning lab on it, and that was part of it last Thursday. So it should be online for them to view too, where we even go over the sheet.
Sounds great. I'll send you the email I have and then add the HVAC contractor on there so you can give probably a little bit more detailed information.
Noel, does the BIA want to comment on this?
If the points in any way favor electric, it's not compliant with 2066. So there may be some work to do there. So I know everybody's trying to figure it out still. So
I get those questions constantly.
It's difficult because State Building Code Council has not made their stance on it yet, but that doesn't make 2066 any less of law. So cannot disincentivize, cannot discourage. So if points are not coming out the right way, and I'm not an expert on points, then it's disincentivizing gas.
Is the plan to update the current energy code for that, or is it to wait until the next code cycle?
Do you want to take that? I feel like we're on a panel now.
State Building Code Council has not made a decision what they're doing with that yet, and so I don't know what their plan is. We as a county have decided not or to try to comply as much as we possibly can. All other jurisdictions in Clark County, as I know it, have not done that and have gone with what the State Building Code Council has requested, which is nothing.
I believe Ridgefield is taking same stance as Clark County. I will give kudos to Clark County because I think they're pretty much the only county in the state that has made the statement that they're trying to comply. I think it's just finding the complete understanding of what that looks like. So I know we're dealing with this on our climate policy project community advisory group as well. So it's a very fine line between. And you technically have two conflicting laws right now. So, but, you know, we might be able to, the climate policy project CAG might be able to lend a hand with some language. So, yeah.
And I definitely want to echo what everybody is. I mean, I don't want to sound like a negative. Definitely appreciate the county taking a stance and moving in the right direction. I think everybody's just in a learning experience and that needs to be ironed out.
I don't get credit for that either. That's Mark Hess. And I think that for us, he made that decision the day it went into law. And so we were able to make that decision before the State Building Code Council came out and said what they said. I don't think he would have been able to make that decision if he would have waited. So.
Absolutely.
Great. All right. Any other public comment? Hearing none, I will entertain a motion to dismiss.
Yeah,
no, we're done. We're dismissed.